the ones that dropped out.
Yeah, I just want to ask you, how much you think that this is, you know, I'm an American from Massachusetts, how much you think this is being driven by something completely outside the country? We know about the Five Eyes and really the complete integration of what was the former British Empire and now still thriving, except with not with London as its center, but Washington, D.C. as its center. It's almost like, you know, so that's like, we were just part of this vast empire, which is part of the global system, and there are globalized cultural forces that are sort of promoting this. They have no ties to any country except whatever seems to be the most convenient form of empire that's going to secure the resources that they want, you know, and then it makes it possible for them to militarize the police, militarize resource extraction, militarize everything. You know, I don't know how much this is really even Canadian coming from Canada, as much as it's coming from some kind of globalized corporate culture.
Yep. I think that's really true. I think that there's like, and in the book I kind of talk about how there is that global thing, and then there's also how that is played out in Canada and how we try and contest it in Canada or local manifestations or different kind of versions of, I guess, better and worse Canadian nationalism that interact with that global thing. And I know there are different schemes, different understandings of how the global capitalist, how power is working in terms of global capitalism. If we want to, somebody like David Harvey would say that global capitalism does have a headquarters in the United States, and that this is the sort of main engine. And I would tend to agree with that, particularly because their military budgets are so much huger than anywhere else in the world. Just blows everybody else off the map. So America really does. The United States really does have that kind of power, which is what we're talking about here. But then I also see a lot of value in Harda Negri's understanding of how power is working globally, which they were writing before the War on Terror began, so things are a little different now. But they were talking about the sort of nodes and flows and not having any headquarters, but just the really, the power of capital completely untethered to any kind of land or territorial or nation state base, where they're able to just do whatever they want. And I found a lot of value in reading that stuff too. Alice?
When did the one of the things we hear about all the time is people going over to visit the graves in France and Holland, crosses row on row. But at some point, the Americans decided that every body and every body part had to come home. I think it may have been Vietnam, but I don't know whether it was as early as Korea. When did Canada make that same decision that every body must come home? Because we certainly buried people overseas during the Second World War. And I don't know what we did in Korea, and we didn't have much experience until fairly recently. And I find it particularly kind of galling to think that we bring everybody back to Canada and drive them down that highway to have an autopsy in Toronto. They've already been dead for some days, and surely if there was any foul play, we would have been looking at that back in Afghanistan or wherever. So I'd be interested in what you know about that tradition.
Nothing. That's a really great question. I'd be interested to pursue it. One of the things that came up in my research and that didn't make it into the book was about the performative aspects of the memorials. When you're thinking about bringing all the bodies home, I'm hearing the question in there about this being part of public spectacle too, like part of how the state is performing this kind of thing for the public. And there's evidence that I couldn't whip together in time, but about several of the crucial moments when political debates were going on in Canada about whether to extend the mission, whether to keep soldiers in Afghanistan, there were these really high-profile cases of flying families of dead soldiers to Afghanistan to have these really public displays of their grief, and people that sounded like they had been coached by PR executives to say things like, "My Billy we have to stay and finish the fight, or his dying will have been in vain. We really have to stay. So, and so that's something that I would still like to pursue. And I've run up against national security concerns when I try and get certain kinds of information, like certain kinds of information from the government about how much they're paying for PR and how PR has been orchestrated in this whole process. Maybe when the government changes. Yeah.
The last words in your formal talk were Canadian values. And I've always wondered how we would define that and what are the elements of Canadian values. But leaving that aside, I've heard recently that the Museum of Civilization in Ottawa, while actually it's across the river, is now going to be changing its focus, thanks to Mr. Harper, who has decided that it in fact exhibits the wrong Canadian values. It exhibits the cosmopolitan nature of Canada. It exhibits the peace, the Trudeau-Pearson era, which he specifically mentions that that's not really what we are. And he wants to put more emphasis on the armed forces. And to me, this is... it's a travesty. It's disgraceful. And this man thinks he can just change the world by changing whatever is in the Museum of Civilization, which is an amazing building, by the way. And so we're stuck now with this kind of power that he seems to have to just change whatever our values, whatever they may be, but they're certainly not war and So I find this really scary because it can happen at so many levels, not just at a museum level. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah, sort of a bit on Colin's comment. Not only is there an attempt to remake the Museum of Civilization, there's actually a debate going on in the Senate about how Canadian history is actually being taught. Okay, so the argument is that Canadian history has incorporated too many of the people who have been excluded and so forth, and therefore needs, as Granatstein has basically been the ideologue of this whole movement, to restore the role of the great man and so forth. So when the anniversary of Vimy Ridge comes around, where Canada was supposedly born as a nation, okay, where we fought for the first time in national military, that will be celebrated, right? And what I think very important, and I really look forward to reading your book in its entirety, I think it's really appropriate that your book is launched here in Halifax, the most militarized city in Canada, okay, where we have the tattoo every year, which is part of the militarization of culture, and just recently we have the militarization of the shipyards, okay, which are going to build these ships, because they brought in a retired admiral, McCoy, from the United States, who has participated in reviving through disciplining labor other shipyards in the U.S., right?
Yeah.
And we have this horrible, tragic case of the suicide of the worker McKenzie, I think it was Peter McKenzie, who committed suicide. Mm-hmm. So we see all of these things unfold, and I think it's really appropriate that, you know, Fernwood is located in Nova Scotia. You're launching this book here in Halifax, right? Mm-hmm. And this is the most militarized city where we have a lot of the greatest propaganda that Halifax benefits from militarization, mm-hmm. and that therefore somehow to oppose war, right, and the demand of a government that's authentically for genuine peace on a world scale, we are somehow being treasonous and so on. So I think your book is really appropriate at this time, and I've especially been launched in a place like Halifax.
Thanks, Isaac. On that point about the propaganda that Halifax benefits from militarization, I think we would need to talk longer about that because I think it does. I mean, I think, I agree, we agree, but we've seen how over its history, the circumstances of Halifax, it's really a wartime economy. It rises and falls with all of these successive wars. So long-term strategies to get us out of that loop are what we need to talk about, definitely. Thank you.
I wonder if you could say or what your take is on the kind of the growing culture of militarism and how that fits into Harper's bigger project, which is kind of a culture of austerity. I don't just mean cutting back on social programs and stuff. I mean creating a kind of a psychology of austerity where people are being psychologically are put in a position where they don't want it. They're not expected to expect anything.
Yeah, that's really true. And in my area, in cultural studies, we talked about that as the neoliberalization of culture. So it's all about privatization of all, of everything that's public, from, you know, the water to, I guess, no social power.
The views
from privatization, removal of barriers to trade, sort of the Washington consensus that this is how things ought to be done. But that also has, not just stripping funding away from social programs and the reallocation of those monies to things like war, but that also has cultural, really profound and pervasive cultural effects, and that the effects don't come without the, you know, it's reciprocal, it's not one or the other. So suffused throughout culture, you get cultures of precarity where people are just so afraid that they'll lose their job, or their, you know, the conditions of work have become so precarious that, you know, casual part-time, you just can't take anything for granted, and it makes people even more individualized and more afraid, and really dissolves community links so that people are even less well prepared to sort of fend off these militarist incursions in their communities. Yeah.
Stupid question, but where does the money go then? Because when I talk to people in the armed forces, they say that, yeah, the big ticket budget items is still to buy all the fancy toys and the propaganda. They don't deny mm-hmm. that. But, you know, they say in terms of actual, like, dental benefits and home allowance to soldiers, they're not getting it, and they feel that they're being, you know, bored off of their lives for these fancy toys. So, it's like, is it like an equal sum for these costs, or is it just a fancy sleight of hand? And the
I should look into those figures more carefully about military budgets and how they actually spend their money. There's a few different things that I'm thinking about when you bring that up. One of them is that there's something called the CFPSA, the Canadian Forces Personnel Support Agency, and it was created to sort of outsource a lot of on-base services that had been previously provided by Canadian Forces members and their families. So before they had been, it was a sort of thing where, like, if you were the partner of a soldier, you could get a job that paid you reasonably well to sort of work in the cafeteria. And this was part of how the forces supported the families of the people that it employed. So if they were relocated to another base, you could get another relatively decent paying job with decent working conditions. And a lot of them were unionized, working on the base. And so for people that have a high degree of mobility, like service people do, this is really important. But then in the late 90s, this came along, this outsourcing of that, and the creation of this separate corporate entity, the CFPSA, which is, on the surface, it's all about taking care of the needs of personnel. It offers different kinds of services. It offers, like, a department store where military members get special discounts and stuff like that. But at the time I was reading up on this, the unions that represented those former employees whose jobs had now been outsourced to private contracting. So now they would be working in, like, private laundries, or, like, in a Tim Hortons chain that was a private operation, no unions, you know, that sort of thing. So it's like the de-skilling and the devaluing of the sort of associated workforce. Reading up on this transformation, there's some really interesting stuff about what people were saying at the time about how, even though this didn't actually even make economic sense for the military, it was about providing flexibility and battle-ready capabilities for the military. So even though they're acknowledging that this doesn't even make financial sense for them, it's not necessarily about creating the cuts aren't necessarily about the cuts. The cuts are about being battle-ready and flexible. So that was the first thing. What was the second thing? about where the money goes and how the actual soldiers don't see it. Maybe they'll come back to me. What do you think?
Oh, no, I think that was part of it.
Okay.
No, I was thinking really. I mean, no.
When I came here tonight, I was wearing a red jacket. And this was my favorite winter jacket for about 3-4 years, until Peter McCabe started the Red Fridays. And so I had to find another jacket to wear on a particular Friday, because there was a rally in my hometown, and I didn't want to be associated with it. And so I tie it in with your yellow ribbon symbolism and all of that. It struck all those "I hate Peter" memories.
And,
and I couldn't talk about Peter that way, because he's a good family man. I'm from his home area. I know him. I don't know his wife, and I haven't met his mother. But they were both, you know, his mother.
His mother is a very active peace activist.
Yes.
And has been for years and years.
Yes.
And years and years.
And as such, Peter's whole family was at this Halifax International Security Forum of NATO admirals and generals and politicians and think tankers and NGOs.
And a solid gathering of war mongers.
A very solid gathering.
Oh, good.
So, his mother, with all due respect, the organization that she's with has lost all of its funding, practically. Now, under the Harper regime.
Yeah.
Something that she has dedicated many years of her life to. And whether you agree or disagree with, you know, her, I happen to agree with her on a lot of things, you know, their funding stuff. His wife, who's touted as this great savior of Save the Children and all of that in war-torn here and there, is the granddaughter of a fascist general in the Shah's army, in the Shah of Iran. So it was right after she started. Anyway, I can't tie this in, her and Peter, with all of a sudden Canada breaking diplomatic relations with Iran, etc., etc. But you tie all these things together. The culture they're promoting. And you were at the anti-war rally last week, which was a great success. Very militant spirit to shake our fists at these warmongers that dare to come into our city. The spirit was such that the culture they have inside was a musician from Africa praising the French for invading Mali. It's the first time they've had entertainers. That's who they had entertaining, praising the French, etc., for helping to save their country. I got competition. Maybe I should shut up. But I very much kind of admire the title you have of this yellow ribbon thing, because there is confusion on that. I support our troops. One of our speakers who wasn't able to show up is a veteran of the Canadian Armed Forces, who in this city, 2, 3, and 4 nights of a week, is strolling around in Skid Row and elsewhere looking for veterans that are just totally tied up in the post-traumatic stress disorder and are down and out in Skid Row kind of thing. There's my support for the troops, is helping those. And to help the young people that used to want to go into the armed forces to learn a trade. Go and join the reserves, learn a trade, get out, boom, you're still young. Now they go in to be sent overseas as cannon fodder. So my support for the troops is to try and keep them from being troops. And if they get back and they're scarred, to help them. But I thank you for being here, and I agree with some of the comments. In this most militarized city in Canada, it's very good. With 4 of our warships and 1 of our submarines right now off our coast participating with American warships in war games. They come back on the 8th. So thank you very much. I should ask a question.
No, thank you.
Forget the question.
I agree that One young man that I met during the course of my research, who was going to join up and went through basic training, and then he decided not to. His expression was, he was drawn by the sort of as I mentioned in the book, I think the desire to contribute, the sort of civic ethos. You want to make the world a better place. He thought that was a way he could serve his country, and found the people that were training him. I think he was infantry, but people in the leadership positions. He said it was like wolves training dogs, and he found it to be completely hollow, completely awful. So he got out of doing that. And I also wanted to just say a word about your Red Fridays experience. Part of what I'm observing and what I think might be the case, what I think is true, is that where the yellow ribbons and the bumper stickers had a lot more widespread use among the public, because of this sort of ambiguity, you don't know if the person supports, if it's to support the war or the soldiers. Compared to that, the Red Fridays campaign was really much more about supporting the war, supporting the government, supporting the soldiers, and really focused around bases. And when it first started happening in Canada, it was all attributed to these two military wives. And they claimed that it was all through them. You already know the end of this story. It was actually from the United States and from the Psychological Operations Division of the Green Berets, which is the unit that is usually called upon to do, I forget what they call it, but foreign regime change. So psychological operations.
Killing Osama bin Laden, that's what they did.
What's that?
Killing bin Laden, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And also creatively changing other people's governments when they don't seek the news of the Americans. So the Red Fridays plan was supposed to, in part, it was intended to fly below the radar of politically correct rules about where you could be political and where you couldn't be political. The claim is always that supporting the troops is not political. That's always the claim. And so this is how Red Fridays began, was to get around rules against political demonstrations by doing something simple like a red shirt that nobody could say to you, that's a political thing. Anyway. John?
Thanks so much for this work, Allison. I have a question. I really appreciate how you started in your opening comments by talking about how peacekeeping was always a myth to begin with.
Yeah.
And so I wonder, in your research, what did you learn? And I know the work is on more recent history, but what did you learn about the kind of ideological work that the peacekeeping idea did and does, also, as you point out, for the left, harkening back to some kind of good old days when we were peacekeepers? What's that all about? So what did you learn about the peacekeeping part of this?
Thanks, John. Thank you. That's a big part of what I talk about, to be sure, and especially drawing on the work of people like feminist and transnational, anti-imperialist, anti-racist feminist types. So like Cynthia Enloe and Shireen Razak, and especially Shireen Razak and others, that are deconstructing the idea of peacekeeping to begin with,
yeah.
That it has been a myth, and that it has been a particularly racial myth. But it's been about creating the idea that there are countries like Canada where there's peace, order, and good government, where there's civility, and these notions are always racially coded as white, right?
Sure.
So white countries like Canada that can go to other places in the world that are coded as being not white and barbarous and backwards and impose democracy as though that were a democratic thing to do.
So far.
Yeah. And so this is all caught up with, and I write about, this is sort of caught up with the sort of colonial fantasy of the sort of Kipling-style white man's burden, right? And that's the way we can understand politics,
yeah.
Is through this. It's almost like a John Wayne caricature, you know?
Like, the Green Berets again.
Yes, the Green Berets again. So, yes, the work that peacekeeping has done, and I think it's a difficulty that we've had this for so long, and that it remains so vibrant. So, like the studies that I'm reading show that, according to the most recent sort of comprehensive polls I've looked at, it shows that not only do most Canadians not support another intervention like Afghanistan, I think only 21% of Canadians supported or somewhat supported another war like that, and most Canadians didn't. And actually, Canadians prioritize spending for healthcare, the environment, jobs and the economy, and even tax cuts over military spending. So military spending is pretty far down on the list of what Canadians say they want, but it's pretty high up in terms of what the federal government's committed to. These polls also show that they would like to, Canadians still believe in and really desire a peacekeeping role for Canada, rather than the sort of NORAD NATO role for Canada. So I think it really shows that even when there's criticisms of peacekeeping as a racial project and a colonial project, that message isn't getting out to most Canadians who still believe there's a good way to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks.
Allison, this is a comment and question. As a member of the Aboriginal community, we're very appreciative of people like Allison and his allies that are helping in our mutual struggle against fracking. And of course, you know, my question is going to be centered around that and your comments on the fight that's taking place in New Brunswick with Elsie Bolton and all that we're going through together.
Thank you for your question. Thank you very much. I think it's what's happening in Elsbuktuk right now is a really great illustration of a lot of these tendencies. I think it's a really great example of this. Because before this ever came to a head, we had not just the David Alward provincial government, but before him we had the Sean Graham, and before that we had Frank McKenna, who were all devoted to this neoliberal economic plan of defunding social programs and putting money into soliciting, and McKenna particularly, soliciting unconventional resource extraction-based companies and soliciting oil and gas money and soliciting these global partners. And McKenna himself was part of the Carlyle Group, which is known as being, Global Warmongers United, right? So there's all those connections going on in the provincial government in New Brunswick before any of this even happened. And the defunding of social programs and the tax cuts that then creates a fiscal crisis. So then they're like, oh, we need money. How are we going to get money? So then they go look into royalties from something like fracking. Right? And so there's a lot more people, like Errol was saying, a lot more people that are willing to buy into the idea that that's an escape. Because people need jobs. People do need jobs. And so so we see the sort of neoliberalization of the economy and social culture, against which we see the most, some of the most shockingly awful and incredibly inspirationally hopeful things that I've ever seen happening in Elsbuktuk, right? Mm-hmm. Where there's been environmental groups and anti-capitalist groups and other groups coming together for a couple of years now, trying to stop fracking from going ahead, and where it's really the First Nations people, the community of Elsbuktuk, and their allies, but the community of Elsbuktuk in particular, that's calling people together and calling people to come to a new understanding, a new relationship with each other. And I think that that's, in spite of the... we can see the state forces at work in terms of the police on the ground, obviously, that continue to just arrest and arrest and arrest and intimidate and beat up people. And also in terms of how the courts are working and refusing to acknowledge or even hear anything about the treaty rights and about how the land is actually unceded and about how the First Nations people actually still obtain original title there. So there's that sort of colonial court, colonial police force thing that's happening. And this is... you'll just indulge me for a second more about this. This is something that I think you could really viscerally feel there, which is that for people in the community who had never... I heard Amy Sock say this. She said, I've never been beaten up before until those police came and beat me up. So this isn't just about how, you know, the police arrest protesters all the time. It's also about the incursion of a colonial police force onto a First Nations community and how that's an act of colonial warfare. And I think people there certainly experience the struggle as colonial warfare, because biological warfare doesn't have to be intentional. And I think people, the harm that's going to happen to the water there is understood to be a kind of biological warfare. Much like smallpox blankets was a form of biological warfare used against indigenous people, right? So that's some of the stuff that I see going on. Thank you. Yeah.
Thanks for this colonial warfare and military water. It's very interesting, and again, I want to add some points from British colonialism that took place in Asia and Africa and elsewhere. Like, for instance, even Cornwallis and Lord Dalhousie went to India and ruined mostly lower caste and lower strata of Indian society. Meanwhile, Gandhi and this Brahmin state were agents for the British in real terms. Like, they weren't the real people who fought against the British. And for instance, I am from a workers family caste from South India. Like, Madras was the major colonial presidency state back in 1900s. And 1852, Lord Dalhousie came to India and mostly occupied most of the local kingdoms who were threatened the British colonial state. Meanwhile, these Brahmins were, according to Hinduism, like, Gandhi was from trading caste, like pretty bourgeois caste, and the Brahmins were like priests who used to feed, you know, chant mantras in the temples, and they weren't they're really concerned of the British occupation and exploitation and looting the country and whatever. But this colonial warfare killed most, millions of lower caste people, who were described as the lower strata of Hindu society. At the same time, this Indian colonial state, soon after the Second World War, 1940s, these Gandhians were had a treaty with the lower caste people, like George Washington back in here in the North American Independent War. Like, he had an agreement with the indigenous people and other sects of American society, you know, overthrowing the British colonial state in Virginia and elsewhere, Boston Tea Party. So likewise, even Gandhians had mutual contacts, which didn't really, address the grassroots level transformation of society and structure of the conservative Hindu society, which in a way, that conservative Hindu society coalesced with the British. So as a result, we are still facing the caste discrimination. You don't have to come to India and, face the casteism. Just go and spend one month in London or Manchester or anywhere. You'll see what is actual casteism, how that works. So my ancestors, and when I went back and read some worker force in colonial state and elsewhere, our ancestors had been deported to Kenya, Namibia, and South Africa, and many of them were killed while making the railway roads and tracks for the British military. And back then, railway force was the major and chief transportation for British colonial state, back in terms of cotton transportation to Manchester. And likewise, there are so many things, but again, I want to say that, this lower strata, weaker sections of the Indian society, conservative Hindu society, who are the real threat for the British colonial state. At the same time, this colonial warfare and military things that have been used by Cornwallis and Dalhousie affected us, mostly indigenous and lower caste people. So So even for to add to these points, this present Indian state is spending like $10 billion on military purchasing, military equipment from France and UK, and even from Canadian state. So, and also this indigenous people and population who are affected by these legacies of colonialism and racism. Just I want to add these points, like, and also I want to ask, like, you know, it's like pretty simple question, like, do we have anything on Cornwallis and Lord Dalhousie in your book?
I don't, but thank you for sharing that. That's really
good. Just I want to add this history, because most of the American folks don't know the realities of conservative Hindu society, how that works and how it is.
There's a book that came out on Cornwallis that was just recently published. You might be interested in getting your hands on.
John Tantry book. Yeah. I heard him speak.
Yeah. Cornwallis, the violent founding of Halifax.
Yeah.
So he was equal opportunist colonialist and oppressor and killer of people.
Including the Scots.
And it seems like wherever there are, I mean, you can confirm or deny, but it seems like wherever there are indigenous people that are connected to the land, that are willing to stand for, or that are standing for a different value system that can't be bought, it seems like that's a place that violence is always brought to people.
Yeah, exactly. Even in Gandhi, like, he didn't talk about land exploitation and looting and occupation of the lands. Was just like, you know, was like using these social reform methods, like, you know, change your mind and thinking ways, and that doesn't change any of their livelihoods who are depend on some lands and things like that. So
it's very theoretical.
I have two questions, Alison. The first question is, given that we have some important anniversaries coming up, very rich, and the 150th anniversary of Confederation, which is basically the establishment of Canada, the codification of the colonial settlers to that is Canada. Mm-hmm. How should we, and specifically speaking, you know, those of us who teach at university or in academy, how should we respond to this? Because there's going to be a tremendous, I can imagine 1812 itself was discussed in War 1812. I can imagine the deluge, right, that will come from the Harper regime on the question of Vimy Ridge and the colonial settler state of Canada, so the British North American Act. The second question I have is, you mentioned these ports, right? And one of the things that stands out is that people are opposed to intervention now in greater numbers and percentages than they were opposed to the war in Iraq, and there's a significant open of things like that. So my question is it's understandable why the Harper regime, given its ideological and political roots, is so much a warmongering regime, right? Some people are worried why certain other established political parties, right, have towed the line, right? Okay, and in a sense have supported all this militarization of Canadian history and Canadian culture, right? And it leads those who are interested in genuine peace and really a genuine war movement, at least some people who are involved, concerned about where do they go, right? Some people believe, obviously, in an independent movement, but there are others who look aghast at the fact that certain political parties who they thought would oppose have stood firmly behind a war policy.
The first thing that you mentioned about how should academics and public intellectuals respond and engage with this onslaught of militarist commemorations, I think that we should be doing everything we can to oppose them and to try and hold open this tiny little space for public debate that's always threatening to shrink around us. There was a note in my book that I think we ended up having to cut, maybe, but it was, which war is it that's supposed to be the founding of the Canadian nation? Because the conservatives and warmongers will pick a new one every time one's coming close, right? So before it was Passchendaele, before it was 1812, somebody had suggested, I forget the other ones, Stony Creek, Queenston Heights, 1812, and Vimy Ridge, so what's the birth of the nation through militarism? And also, of course, for those of us in this room, I think, like, all of that has a particularly fascist resonance, right? That's what we hear when we hear that. I know I've spoken with many of you personally, who are really alarmed by that kind of, like, foundation of a nation in blood, blood and soil kind of rhetoric and where that's tending. So I think that we should be organizing and speaking as much as we can about that not being all. And there's so many other things that didn't get into the book, too, that you've mentioned, like the rewriting of the guide for the immigration guide, that's re-scripting what people have to say and be familiar with when they're going through the immigration process, and the suggestion that there should be soldiers present if possible so that people can sort of bow down before the presence. That kind of valorization of the military in civilian life that's looking really dangerous. Well, proto-fascist.
Yes.
And the second thing that you brought up was what about our political parties and those of us who want general movement and genuine movements and genuine change? And so I agree with you that it's sort of shocking to see how the majority of political parties capitulate, and it can sometimes feel like there's no alternatives left for those of us who want not just tinkering, but a really different system. I was thinking about this as I was going to be interviewed on the radio, and then I wasn't. But I think when she found out what the book was about. I was thinking about democracy and whether to use the word democracy on the radio or if we should just hang up that word and stop using it because it's been so conflated with, it means capitalist democracy. We don't know any other kind. And it means colonial, imperialist, capitalist democracy. So those of us who actually want something like equality and want to see us be able to value each other's skills and take care of each other, I think we need a new word. And that doesn't mean, that doesn't lock us into this wringing our hands over how democracy is in peril all the time. That gets us out of that and into being able to think together about a different future.